You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa ko otu toku ingoa. Nau mai, hare mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, and welcome to The Wire for Rāapa Wednesday. I'm your host Otto, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Max. Ewhai aki nei coming up on the show for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party. I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez March about the government's plan to consider recognizing a Palestinian state, the Greens' petition to restore Te Reo names of Wellington electorates, and the most recent Taxpayers Union Curia poll. I speak to Tom Hunt from E2 Union's Media Delegates Committee about the killing of 5 Al Jazeera journalists by Israel in Gaza. And I speak to Stefan Hoadley, a retired Associate Professor of International Relations at the University of Auckland, about the upcoming talks between Trump and Putin to negotiate a ceasefire in Russia's war on Ukraine. Max, what have you got for us today?
I speak to John Morgan from the University of Auckland to talk about why the recent proposal to drop NCEA might be part of a larger global shift.
He aha o whakaro. I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātui mai, text in on 5395, or waia mai rāne, give us a call in the studio on 09309 3879. Kaua e wareware ahe ana koutou te whakurongo ki ēne, kōrero anō he pakiheri rokiroki marunga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi pōho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
Earlier this week, Foreign Minister Winston Peters announced that the government would be announcing its position on the recognition of a Palestinian state over the course of the next month. This announcement was made in the lead-up to the UN General Assembly in September, where world leaders, such as the Prime Ministers of France and Australia, promised to recognize a Palestinian state. Also this week, Green Party Wellington MPs Julianne Genter and Tamatha Paul launched a petition calling for Māori place names to be restored to Wellington electorates after the Rongotai electorate was recently renamed to the English name of Wellington Bays. And the latest Taxpayers Union Curia poll was recently released, which showed that Labour had overtaken National as the largest party, gaining 2 points to 33.6%, while National dropped 2.1 points to 31.8%. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, we spoke to MP Ricardo Menendez March to get the party's take on all of these issues. To begin, what was the Green Party's reaction to Winston Peters' announcement concerning the recognition of a Palestinian state?
Well, first of all, there is no clear plan to do the absolute bare minimum, which is to recognize Palestinian statehood. And for all the talk of the Prime Minister about taking an independent foreign policy, he is far more aligned with the Trump administration on this issue than the rest of the world. We're actually now one of the few countries in the world who hasn't committed to a proper and immediate recognition of Palestinian statehood while a genocide is happening. Children are starving and journalists are being killed by their own admission by Israeli forces.
Are you confident that the government will make the decision to recognize a Palestinian state over the course of the next month?
No, because the government has had years to do it. But we've got to take it back to the biggest issue here, which is the genocide that is unfolding. And they need to do far more than recognition of Palestinian statehood. We need to put sanctions on Israel and advocate far more for Israel to stand down and to join the ICJ case to hold Israel to account for its war crimes. The biggest challenge that we have here is that without consequences, Israel will continue its genocidal campaign, and that will leave more children being actively starved by Israel and more journalists who are telling the truth and shining a spotlight on this genocide being murdered.
Peters said that the demilitarization of Hamas would be a needed prerequisite for New Zealand to recognize Palestine, with David Seymour additionally saying that all Israeli hostages in Gaza would need to be released as well. How would you respond to that?
Even Israeli families are alarmed at the Israeli government's new plan to fully take over the city of Gaza, and they recognize that that will put the lives of those Israeli people in Gaza at risk. And at no point, Luxon or Seymour seem to show any level of concern for the lives of Palestinian children who are being starved to death. And it shows that they're far more aligned with the Trump administration, who is supporting a genocidal campaign, than standing up for human rights and their basic humanity. This will be a stain in our record for a country that claims to have led the way on, for example, giving women the right to vote, on taking a nuclear-free stance, and now we've completely abandoned those values and have decided to side with Trump and his genocide apologist politics.
Alongside recognizing a Palestinian state, how would a Greens-led government diplomatically approach the situation in Gaza and the establishment of a two-state solution?
Immediate recognition of Palestinian statehood is indeed one of the first steps that we can take. But right now, the focus needs to be on stopping this genocide, because there will be nothing left to protect in Gaza if we don't put consequences on Israel. And what that includes is, again, sanctioning Israel, ensuring that our government agencies divest from any funds that support Israel as well, and that we join the ICJ case to hold Israel to account for its war crimes. A two-state solution cannot happen if Israel is intending on taking over Gaza and basically annexing it. So this is why the immediate and most pressing issue is to stop the killing and starving of people on the ground in Gaza.
I'd also like to ask you about Chloe Swarbrick's ejection from Parliament yesterday by Speaker Jerry Brownlee for comments she made during the debate on the recognition of Palestine. What kind of a message do you think her ejection sends to everyone looking at how New Zealand is handling the situation in Gaza at the moment?
I think people can see it for what it is, which is that government and peace seem far more offended about the critiques of their inaction to tackle a genocide unfolding in front of our eyes and being live streamed on our phones than the genocide itself. What the speaker did yesterday is unprecedented. I myself had the opportunity to challenge the speaker on this issue. He walked back the sort of suspension for a week and reduced it to a day. But then he's now going to be requiring Chloe to basically apologize today, as far as we know. And what this shows again is that government and peace, and the speaker unfortunately included, seem far more interested in optics around pretty tame language rather than the killing of children and the starvation of a whole people in Gaza.
All right, moving on to the next topic. Green Party Wellington MPs Julianne Genta and Tamatha Paul have recently launched a petition calling for Māori place names to be restored to Wellington electorates. This comes after the Rongotai electorate was recently renamed to the English name of Wellington Bays just last week. So next, I'd like to ask, can you tell us about the petition and its calls from your perspective?
Our Wellington Bays MPs are really concerned about the fact that, at least when it comes to Rongotai, which is a Māori name that basically talks about how we feel the coast, has been now changed to Wellington Bays, following literally about, I think it was three submissions against it. And the concern that we have around this is that this is part of an affront towards Te Reo Māori. You know, today we've just seen how Erica Stanford is basically removing all Māori words from books and the education system out of wanting to prioritize English without acknowledging that Māori is one of our official languages. And so we want to make sure that we protect Māori place names where we do have them, that we treat Te Reo Māori as the taonga that it is, and that we focus on actually investing in an education system that allows people to learn Te Reo Māori in order to fulfill our Te Reti obligation.
Do you think that this specific name change might begin a trend that might continue for other electorates across the country?
It could well be, but it is already a trend across the country, led by particularly people in positions of power, including in our government, to take away Māori names from our institutions and our places, all because these people in positions of power are wanting to basically attack Māori rights, Māori sovereignty, and pretend that Māori don't have the important and critical place in Aotearoa as one of the Te Reti partners who allow people like yourself and myself to be in this land to begin with.
The Representation Commission said that the new names in Wellington were changed purely to reflect the geographic areas the electorates now cover. How would you respond to that?
As a factually incorrect. And the fact that this was led by literally about, I think it was three submissions against it, shows that this was a decision that was probably more led by an ideological approach that is anti-Te Reo Māori. And again, if we look at even just what is happening this morning with Erica Stanford further attacking Te Reo Māori in our education system, it just shows that we have a problem with people in positions of power wanting to undermine Māori rights and Māori sovereignty. And as a migrant to this country, I know that Te Tiriti is the thing that allows me to be in this place. And I want all of us to fight for the rights of Te Reo Māori to be treated for the taonga that it is so that we can all thrive.
All right, moving on to the last topic. The latest Taxpayers Union Curia poll was recently released, which showed that Labour had overtaken National as the largest party, gaining 2 points to 33.6%, while National dropped 2.1 points to 31.8%. Additionally, the Greens' approval rating had increased by 0.4 points to 9.8%, while ACT and NZ First had fallen by 0.5 and 2% respectively. So next I'd like to ask, what was the Green Party's reaction to the poll numbers?
We've always been pretty cynical about polling results, because if we had heard the polls and taken that as an indication of our mahi, we would have never won the seats of Auckland Central, Wellington Central and Rongotai, where the polls were showing us that it was almost impossible to win them. This is why our focus has been on talking to people on the ground, getting out there in our communities and talking to new audiences to build power, to make sure that this is a one-term government and that we can put in place policies that create 40,000 jobs, that ensure that we can tax the rich so that people can have adequate things like healthcare. And this is where our focus is. Polls will show every political party moving up and down every now and then, but the only result that matters is actually the number of people we talk to and the election results.
Will the shift in voter preferences indicated in this poll have an impact on the Greens' campaign strategy going forward?
No, because we are led by our values, our connections to our communities, and our desire to make sure that we're on the ground talking to as many people as we can. And I'm really proud that we have a group of volunteers and organizers who are getting out there in the communities at market stalls, door knocking for the local government election campaigns, and who are focused on building power where it lies, which is with the people, not necessarily in places like Parliament.
And how would a Greens-led government address the anxieties shared by voters who answered this poll?
What we've seen in polls, but also with the feedback on the ground, is that people are concerned about the fact that jobs are being cut and people are being left without adequate employment opportunities while people on the benefits suffer. This is why our focus relies on creating 40,000 jobs in the construction sector as well as in Jobs for Nature, which allows us to protect our waterways and our streams to prevent floods in our communities. This is where the focus is, and these are the conversations we're having people on the ground about how we can build an Aotearoa that works for all of us, not just greedy corporations.
And that was Green Party MP Ricardo Menendez-March talking to us about the government's plan to consider recognizing a Palestinian state, the Greens' petition to restore Te Reo names to Wellington electorates, and the most recent Taxpayers Union Curia poll.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Last Sunday, Israeli Defense Forces fired an airstrike on a media tent outside the Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City. The Israeli airstrike killed seven of Al Jazeera's Gaza correspondents, who were Anas Al-Sharif, Mohammed Kareke, Ibrahim Zahir, Mohammed Nufal, Momen Aliwa, and Mohammed Al-Khalidi. This airstrike would bring the total number of journalists killed in Gaza by Israel to 238. Etu Union's National Journalist Committee recently put out a statement condemning the killing of those Al Jazeera journalists and called for urgent international action to ensure journalists were protected. I spoke to Tom Hunt, a delegate from Etu Union's National Delegates Committee, about the killing of those five of seven Al Jazeera journalists by Israel in Gaza and Etu's stance on the issue. So to begin, can you tell us about Etu's response to the recent killing of five Al Jazeera journalists in Gaza?
Yeah, well, of course. We put out a release yesterday. It's a bit of a kind of, not much on the scale of things that are happening, of course, but just strongly condemning the killing of journalists over there, because, of course, Etu is, among other things, the journalist union and closely aligned with various international journalist unions and organisations. So we just wanted to come out and strongly condemn it. I don't think it's going to make one iota of difference, unfortunately, but that's what it is.
How would you assess the New Zealand media's coverage of those killings?
Of the killings? I mean, I'm reading about it in the paper today. I've got some sitting here in front of me, I think it's been pretty down the line. The problem we've got with anything inside Gaza right now is that you really can't get media in there apart from the people like this who have just been killed to actually report on it from the ground. So anything inside Gaza is virtually, you know, it's always by nature secondhand unless you have people like you know, brave people like this inside Gaza who are willing to report out and risk their lives for it, evidently.
Do you think that journalists across New Zealand have done enough to show solidarity with those Al Jazeera journalists killed in Gaza?
Probably not, to be honest. But in saying that, it's kind of hard to know what to do. You know, in terms of specifically for journalists, it's kind of, apart from putting out statements, I guess we could set up a solidarity fund or something like that, but it's kind of, I'm a bit of a loss what to do, but, if someone comes up with a good idea, I'm sure we'd be keen to listen.
Regarding our government's response, what do you think an adequate response from our government would be?
In some ways, I don't know if it's a government thing to do. I mean, it's more that they, I mean, I wouldn't expect the New Zealand government to specifically single out the murderer of journalists as opposed to any other civilian over there and specifically condemn that. That's probably more for people like journalist unions and people to do, but we're not asking for any special treatment of journalists, just to stop killing people. But I'm probably more qualified to talk about the killing of journalists, but I wouldn't expect the New Zealand government to take special treatment of them.
Winston Peters recently announced that the government would announce their stance on the recognition of a Palestinian state over the next month. Do you think that this would be enough to address both the killing of those journalists and the killing of civilians in Gaza in general?
Just like I said before, I mean, we're a small country at the bottom of the world. I don't think it's going to make any big difference, but it's probably a positive step forward to reflect the feelings of, I think, most of New Zealanders. There probably is some sort of harm in it in terms of trade and stuff like that, but I think it would probably reflect the feelings of most of New Zealand. But unfortunately, I don't think anything like that's going to make a big difference. It's not going to stop what's going on there.
Do you think that greater protections for journalists here at home is also needed?
Yeah, it feels a bit kind of trite to say that the attacks on journalists here in any way equate to the things that are happening over there. I mean, we're not getting killed. But in saying that, there has definitely been increased, social media and other attacks on journalists here. And what would be the ideal situation is if people took a bit more of a holistic view on things and realised that journalists might one day write something they don't like and then the next day write something they do like, and they're doing a job just like any other person. So it comes down to maybe people just being a bit more growing up, really. But there is protections there. There is from the government. There, you know, there's the Harmful Communications Act and whatnot. So they are there. I mean, I just call on people to just be a bit more mature and realise people are doing their job. And with a shrinking, number of staff in newsrooms, it's harder to cover everything. But the personal attacks would be great if they stopped.
And that was Tom Hunt, a delegate from Etu Union's National Delegates Committee, speaking to us about the killing of Al Jazeera journalists by Israel in Gaza and Etu's stance on the issue. We'll be right back after a quick break. Keep it on the B.
95.
I can really feel the flow.
place in your heart that I can't get into. And God is calling. It's been years since you've been back. You can't keep what's in your hands. And God is calling. Every time I say your name, there's a wall that's in the way. On a street where everyone meets, all our living rooms were aflame. But you led the way, had to hold it all and take the day. You wear that scarf like it's a fame. Always pack your mother's plates. You won't let anything else escape. And I can't write you a letter, you don't know how to read. You won't listen either, so when can I tell you how I feel? How I feel. And God is calling. It's been years since you've been back. You can't keep what's in your hands. And God is calling.
Mr. Bond, we meet at last. A vodka martini, shaken, not stirred, I presume?
Give me a stiffy, but don't shake it, for God's sake. It'll go everywhere.
Enjoy this stiffy, Mr. Bond. It may be your last.
Every Thursday on Drive with Half Queen, it's the happiest hour of all. Cocktail Corner, brought to you this month by Stiffy, your new favourite caffeinated, low-sugar, 7% party starter. Check them out at stiffydrinks.co.nz.
It's only up from here. Picky Picky, the debut album from Geneva AM, is out August 15, and we have copies of the vinyl to give away. Just listen in to 95 BFM Breakfast all week and keep your B-card handy for your chance to win. Picky Picky, Picky, Picky by Geneva AM. Get your pre-orders today. Album out August 15, wherever good music is found.
Okay, Meadow, we can't lose again or it's off to the factory. Go, Meadow, go! No, other way! Don't you want to live?
Gonna get there, good horse. Headway wins the Spring Cup.
Oh no, Meadow. I won't let them take you, Meadow. We'll find a way. I just saw a documentary about a basketball playing Labrador. Maybe you can learn an unconventional sport too.
Pony Pete.
Ping Pong with Matt and Aaron, bringing as much entertainment to your Friday night as a Shetland pony skee-balling the table edge. With a mix of mashdowns, candid conversation, cheap shots and mystery celebrity nakedness. Pony Ping Pong, Friday, 9 till 11 p.m., only on 95BFM.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Once again, let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Many questions have come up in recent weeks due to the government's proposal to ditch the NCEA curriculum by 2030. Most people are wondering what the future of education will look like in Aotearoa, given that NCEA has been used throughout most of New Zealand since the start of the millennium. Professor John Morgan is the head of the School of Critical Studies and Education at the University of Auckland. Morgan published an article earlier this week to look at what caused NCEA to be introduced in the first place and what the larger context of this new educational reform is. I spoke to Morgan to discuss how recent global events have impacted education and what the future of schools might look like in Aotearoa. You've related our current situation to the educational reforms and culture changes in the 80s and 90s. Can you explain why these two timelines are comparable?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for me, the changes which took place during the 1990s around tomorrow's schools were the solution. At that point, more children left school early. Less went on to university. The economy was sort of more able to accommodate people leaving early. There was sort of a less reliance on high skills and the post-industrial future and so on. And so schooling worked in the sort of period 1950 to 1975 pretty well. But as globally, the economy began to shift and places like New Zealand struggled to maintain their traditional forms of economy, the modes of schooling, the types of schooling that we had to offer changed. And it took place in the United States, Australia, Britain a little bit earlier. New Zealand hung on, but it was in the 1980s with the fourth Labour government that suddenly the economy first, the market first approach kicked in. And the result of that was a sort of a set of changes around education. Specifically, the changes were to do with the fact that we were imagining ourselves as a small Pacific nation battling in a global world. We had to be competitive. The Porter Report of 1990 told us this. We needed a high-skills future. We couldn't accept the long tail of educational achievement. And also there was a sense in which the forms of knowledge and curriculum which we were relying upon, which were effectively sort of the banking model where we pour information and knowledge into kids through school subjects, was being sort of challenged by educational thinking. It was much more skills-based, competence-based, rewarding people for what they could do rather than what they know. And teachers themselves were sort of empowered by that type of change because it gave them more, you know, they became pedagogical experts in teaching and learning. They had more of a role in the whole process of schooling. So I sort of see that moment of the 1980s and 1990s as pivotal to shifting us to what we have been experiencing over the last 20 years, and that's been the sort of dominant educational idea.
And now that we will see its end, do you think that the NCEA curriculum has been a success?
I think in many ways it was successful in shifting us from the old model. It loosened things up. It gave teachers more autonomy to make connections with children. It included more students. More students achieved rather than sort of being deemed educational failures at a sort of an early age. Certainly the skills, the softer skills have given a wider view of intelligence. And you know, we've had technological shifts, which means schools in some ways, although they look very similar to what your grandmother might have gone to school in, they've changed in many ways in terms of what the content, assessment and teaching and learning. So I think it's been successful in that. However, I think that what we're seeing now is the delayed effect of the impacts of the global financial crisis in 2008. NCEA was a qualification system which was geared towards an economy which was largely still growing at 1 or 2% per year, that it was still meeting the economic needs. Many countries have rejected this more, I suppose, loose educational assessment regime a little bit earlier. So if you think about Britain and Australia, they've taken moves to reform their examination systems much earlier than we have. And so I think we're sort of seeing the end of that moment. It works less well. There's a sense in which the whole basis of scoring has been geared towards, or some aspects of scoring have been geared towards credit farming and making sure we go through, we collect enough credits in order to meet the criteria. Whether that's going to meet the sort of the long-term challenges of New Zealand's society in the future is unclear, really. I mean, the question we always have to ask in education is, are generations getting more skilled, more intelligent, more able to face the problems that the world throws up for them? And really, and I think there is a debate to be had about whether NCEA is meeting that need. Unfortunately, I think that debate's got quite polarised between the sort of what I would call the sort of the broad centre-left, which composes most of the educational establishment in universities and research thinking, and many teachers, against what is sometimes seen as a sort of a right-wing, revanchist, back-to-the-future type sort of national government. And I don't think that's a helpful binarism to have. I think we need to move beyond that debate to think what next.
Do you think that education in New Zealand will eventually be defined by a pre-COVID and a post-COVID timeline?
That's really interesting. I mean, I think that was a question which was being posed internationally around sort of 2020 and 2021 and the return. I think what's interesting is that the debate around COVID has quickly, in many ways in education, that died down. I think we see the effects of this. I think we see it in school attendance. I think we see it in generalised anxiety. But often it's not named as such because I think it's wrapped up with another set of problems to do with the precarity of the economy, economic futures, and also ongoing shifts around climate change. But I think there are some real questions which COVID is wrapped up in, which is that for most of us, we went to school where our teachers were able to say, work hard, do well, get your exams, and you will live a better life and you'll be richer and better off than your parents. And I think we're in a situation where a whole generation, we can't honestly say that to them. And I think that's a bit of a game changer for educationalists to have to consider. And we haven't worked out how to do that. So I don't know whether we'll call it pre-COVID, post-COVID. The great British historian Peter Hennessy said that's how history will define itself, the pre and post-COVID. All those other categories won't matter. But I don't know. I mean, time will tell. But certainly COVID was a shock to the system, and I think it's wrapped up with some other systemic changes.
For some context, in your article you mentioned New Zealand currently existing in a stage where the old is dying, but the new has not been born yet. Do you think these problems are a result of New Zealand struggling to accept where we are in 2025, given the amount of changes in recent years?
I think it's collectively, it's not just New Zealand. I think that there's a gradual recognition that the global financial crisis and the way in which that is impacting economics, politics and culture is being worked out in quite sort of complicated and sort of unfathomable ways in many ways. You know, add to that the generative AI and the technological shifts that are occurring, the fact of war and the return of war to mainland Europe, continuing crises in the Middle East. I think there's a sense in which that we will see this period of 2010 onwards as a sort of a period when an old system was beginning to break down and something else hadn't yet replaced it. Like, so for instance, the IMF economist in 2014 announced that neoliberalism as an economic policy is dead, but I don't think many of us believe that, and it still feels as though we live in that period. But it feels as though there's sort of we have to shift to something new, but we don't quite know what it's going to be. I mean the people who the political economists who analyze this stuff tell us this is pretty common. So the breakdowns of the Great Depression lead eventually to the post-war social democratic state. The breakdown of that in the 1970s with the oil crisis, it leads eventually to the emergence of market-based economies in the late 1980s. And so we see this sort of period of 10 or 15 years where things have to settle down and a new settlement is emerging. And I think education is one part of that.
And from your perspective then, how do we get out of this interregnum period?
Oh, I think we pay very close attention to what is happening in the realms of social relations, economy, politics and culture. As educators, we try to understand that education is one part of how that is reflected in society. And we try to have a serious, I suppose, sort of cultural and political argument about where we want to go. I mean, for instance, one of the arguments now is that, you know, all of our jobs will be replaced by AI. Well, we sort of know from previous waves of technology that doesn't really happen. Doesn't mean that some jobs won't be lost, but the economy won't be shifted completely. We know that the transition to a, you know, if we're able to make a transition to a sort of a green, low-carbon economy or zero-carbon economy, that's going to change the way we live, the way we think, the way we sort of do business, the way we educate it. So we have to sort of have some futures thinking. The UNESCO has produced some interesting reports on educational futures, which are go beyond the idea that simply the economy is going to be smarter, cleaner version of what we've got already, and suggest that we need to have some more intergenerational thinking about how we relate to the planet, how we relate to each other, the types of lives we want to live. Do we want to be speeding around the planet on planes, or do we want to sort of be living more local lives? These are all questions which we have to resolve in society. And education should be part of that debate, and unfortunately, I don't see it being reflected in our discussions as yet. I suppose that's why I wrote the article.
And just to finish up, do you have a personal idea or forecast for what New Zealand's education might look like moving forward?
Oh, I think for the next 10 to 15 years, 10, maybe 10 to 12 years, we will hobble on trying to reinvent our systems and trying to sort of make it with what we've got. I think we will probably mimic some of the high status type qualifications that we see happening in Britain and to a certain extent in Australia. And that's because there's a great demand for these portable, high status exam-based qualifications such as IB and Cambridge. But I think there'll be another track going on, which is a conversation about alternative forms of education will begin to follow through. So we may see the sort of rejection of technological forms of education. We may see much more sort of what you would call localized and community-based forms of schooling emerging. We may not even call them schooling. So, I mean, that, things like homeschooling, sort of the sort of alternative forms of education system may evolve alongside. So I don't think there could be a great shock to the system unless we have some sort of cataclysmic climate shock. But I think we will gradually evolve different ways of thinking about the purposes and aims of education.
And that was John Morgan from the University of Auckland on why education in Aotearoa is in its current state and what the future of schools might look like. We'll be right back after this short break. 95 BFM. We'll be right back.
kiss men.
The Wire.
But I kissed him.
No mai hoki mai anō. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Once again, if you have any thoughts on any of the pieces we've played today, please give us a text on 5395 or call us in the studio on 309-3879. We appreciate the feedback, whether it's good or bad. In the lead-up to the U.S. presidential elections, one of Donald Trump's key campaign promises was to broker a truce between Russia and Ukraine within 24 hours, dubbing himself the President of Peace. Almost 7 months into Trump's presidency and more than 3 years since Russia began its invasion of Ukraine, the war has only continued to escalate and no peace or ceasefire deals have been achieved yet. However, hopes for a ceasefire between Russia and Ukraine have been reignited for some following the announcement of talks between Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin that will take place this Friday. However, there have been some concerns surrounding those same talks, noting that Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky and other EU leaders haven't been invited, with Russia insisting on holding on to its territorial gains as part of any ceasefire negotiations. I speak to Stefan Hoadley, a retired associate professor of international relations at the University of Auckland, to discuss the upcoming talks between Russia and Putin to negotiate a ceasefire in Russia's war on Ukraine. Can you give us a rundown on the main focus of the upcoming talks between Trump and Putin?
Putin wants to keep the territory that he's achieved by military aggression. Trump wants to stop the fighting altogether so that he can appeal to the Nobel Committee for a peace prize. It's an impasse in the sense that the two sides are incompatible, and also that the Ukrainian view is not being taken into account. The Ukrainians apparently are not going to be at the peace talks. Well, the ceasefire talks, I think, is more accurate. There's not going to be a peace, but maybe there'll be a ceasefire. And the Europeans are not going to be there either. The Europeans, of course, are on the front line and want to be involved in the discussions. So it's an awkward situation, Otto.
So what conditions will Putin likely be laying out for him to accept a ceasefire deal?
Putin wants to keep what he has achieved on the battlefield. He has partially occupied four provinces and completely occupied Crimea. So there are five entities or five portions of southeastern Ukraine that has Russian troops on it. And Putin wants to legitimize this and annex those portions into the Russian Federation. He wants also, in his dreams, he wants Ukraine to surrender the last bits of Donetsk and Luhansk to Russian forces. They're still held partially by Ukrainian forces. And in his dream of dreams, he wants the Ukrainian government to capitulate and for Ukraine to become neutralized, disarmed, pledge never to join NATO, and to become, in effect, like Belarus, a satellite of Russia. So Putin has big dreams, and these run directly contrary to the nationalistic, patriotic sentiments of the Ukrainians, who regard themselves as quite separate from the Russians and quite willing to fight to retain their independence.
With Zelensky and other EU leaders being excluded from these talks, what outcomes do you expect to be brought for the Ukrainian side?
I expect there'll be a lot of hyperbole, a lot of rhetoric. Putin and Trump will both claim victory in the discussion. There will be very little substance, and Ukraine will complain that their views have not been taken into account, and the Europeans likewise will complain that their views have not been taken into account. Since the Europeans are on the front line next to Ukraine and are, in effect, holding Russia back from further expansion. So I'm pessimistic that the talks will accomplish anything. It is possible that there could be a very temporary ceasefire with the Russians and the Ukrainian forces remaining in place along the current line of contact, and that a exchange of prisoners could take place. Perhaps there could be other kinds of temporary settlement. But the Ukrainian intelligence agencies are telling us that the Russian forces are not preparing to stand down and take a rest. They're, in fact, redeploying, moving around in such a way that indicates an offensive operation that will begin before too long. Putin has certainly not conceded that Ukraine is an illegitimate entity, that it really should be under Russian control. The Ukrainians have not budged from their position that they want to cede no territory. The latest news, by the way, Otto, is that the Ukrainians apparently have said, look, we possibly can cede de facto control to the Russians of those five provinces, the four provinces plus Crimea, in return for a ceasefire. That is de facto, not de jure, not legal. So Ukraine would continue to claim the right to take back those provinces, but in the meantime, they would stand their troops down and not challenge Russian control over those portions of the five provinces that Russia now occupies. This would be the price they'd be willing to pay for a ceasefire, to stop those nightly waves of drones and missiles that are bombarding the residential areas of Ukrainian cities. So there is a possibility of a temporary ceasefire, one which would freeze the current military position in place, but which would not solve the underlying dilemma, the underlying conflicting views of the two principal parties, Russia and Ukraine.
Should these talks result in a ceasefire deal, how likely is it that Ukraine might consider the terms of that deal to be unacceptable or unreasonable?
As long as there are Russians still in Ukrainian territory, the Ukrainians, particularly Zelensky, assuming he remains the president, and there has been some rumors that he might be replaced and sometime in the future, and a more accommodating president might make concessions. But let's assume that Zelensky remains in place. He will continue to argue as long as there is one Russian soldier on Ukrainian soil. Ukraine will continue to protest that in a legal sense. Now, militarily, Ukraine is at a disadvantage. They're one-third the population of Russia. They depend on American arms, particularly air defense missiles, artillery shells, and other essential things for the day-to-day combat. And Donald Trump is, of course, vacillating and indicating he's willing to compromise. Somehow he sees Putin's point of view. And so the Ukrainians are in an awkward position that they've got to make sure that Trump continues the flow of essential weapons so that Ukrainians can continue to hold off the Russians. So their challenge is not just military, but it's also political. And it involves the ego of Donald Trump. And this makes a multi-variable problem for Zelensky, not just a simple military problem.
So aside from boosting Trump's ego and possibly achieving a Nobel Peace Prize, is there anything else that the American side is looking to get from these talks?
Well, yeah, the American side is divided. I think the American military, they'd like to see this cease because they want to keep the weapons themselves. The United States arsenals are being gradually run down as weapons are sent to Ukraine. I should add, these are old weapons. The United States keeps its newest and best and sends along its near obsolescent weapons to Ukraine, which is still quite useful. And the military are concerned that this conflict continue and this drain on American military resources, which should be directed to balancing China in Asia, should stop. Trump wants instant gratification of instant peace so he can claim victory and fulfill his campaign promises. The Republican base, the alt-right supporters of Trump, they want no more wars. They don't want the United States to do anything abroad. Not war, not economic aid. They want trade only on American terms. Quite unreasonable vis-a-vis the previous decades of globalization. They want to reverse globalization and go back to great power nationalization. So there are many different currents swirling in Washington, pulling in different ways, but it's very unfortunate in the sense that the United States and Russia, the United States and Europe, that are natural allies, are now drawing apart are diverging because the Europeans are quite committed that they need to stop Russia where they stand, because the Europeans will be next victims of Russian aggression. And the United States, safe behind the Atlantic Ocean and concerned maybe more with China than with Europe, seems to be under Trump vacillating and may not be a stalwart partner in NATO, may not continue to send essential weapons to Ukraine if the Ukrainian president isn't very polite to Donald Trump, the individual, and that this is undermining the Western solidarity, the Western consensus of globalization, peace, prosperity, and the humanitarian welfare for all.
And do you think that Trump might take any punitive measures towards Russia if Putin refuses to make concessions to achieve a ceasefire?
Well, I sincerely hope so. From time to time, Trump says he's pissed off with Putin. I wish he would continue to be irritated because he wants peace and Russia continue to bomb Ukraine. And it is the Russians who are perpetrating the war. The Ukrainians would be quite happy to stop fighting if the Russians stop bombing and stop probing in the southeastern military lines of contact. And Trump should be irritated because he should realize, and maybe his more adult advisors are telling him exactly that. Whether he's listening or not, we don't know, probably not. But the advisors will be saying, look, Putin is the bad guy here. Pat Putin is the aggressive. Ukraine is the victim. And we should support the victim and stabilize the battle lines and protect Western Europe, particularly Poland, the Baltic states, Romania, Moldova, because if Russia captures Ukraine, then the other countries of Europe, particularly NATO countries, might suffer military pressure or hybrid warfare or subversion or even military attack by Russia in the future. And as I said, World War II indicated Hitler could have been stopped by a small show of defiance early on, but once Hitler got up momentum, it took a major war to stop the Nazis. And so maybe we're at one of these turning points where we should stand firm and exert some energy and some resources and some political will to stop Russia where it is now, because if we don't stop Russia now, then there'll be a bigger war needed to be fought in the future.
And that was Stefan Hoadley, a retired associate professor of international relations at the University of Auckland, talking to us about the upcoming talks between Trump and Putin to negotiate a ceasefire in Russia's war on Ukraine.
That was The Wire.
Koe rā te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki au mō tēnei rā.
That's a wrap on The Wednesday Wire, thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. The Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March, Tom Hunt from A2 Union's National Media Delegates Committee, John Morgan from the University of Auckland, and Stefan Hoadley, formerly from the School of Social Sciences at the University of Auckland. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakorongo ana. Thanks for tuning in to 95BFM. Next up is the Wednesday 1-4 with Bridge. Have a great day and keep it on the B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.